Right, we're in Malachi 2, chapter 2, verses 1 through 17. We're in Malachi 2. This is the 22nd part of the survey of the prophets of the restoration. And we're looking at Malachi, who is a prophet separated from Haggai and Zechariah by a number of decades. His time frame is correlated more with Nehemiah than with Ezra, like the previous two. And in fact, in chapter 2, we're going to see some correlations, some concerns that Malachi shares with Ezra. Keep in mind, he's talking to a people who now have a restored temple, and they're in danger of really falling away from that purity that God has commanded. And so Malachi is giving us a glimpse of a couple of things. He's giving us a little bit of a sense of the disarray that's going to be in Israel at the time that Christ comes the first time. He's going to be... Christ is going to come at a time when, in some respect, the Jews are not really ready for all of that. They're not really prepared to meet with all of the requirements that Messiah is going to be looking to. And as it's looking forward in that sense to the end of that first era, when we talk about the building of the second temple, when we think about it in terms of the millennium, I think we're getting a glimpse of how things are going to deteriorate toward the end of the millennium. But these are also the way things deteriorate or tend to deteriorate at the end of any revival or reformation of the church. So these are all signs of the end of something, which also point to the beginning of something new. So although Malachi has a specific historical context, I think we can understand, or we should understand, that the people of God, the church, behaves in a way that, in fact, is actually relatively predictable. There's a period of time where there's disobedience, a corrupting of the worship of God, and it's followed by judgment. We're going to see, in fact, that this period of time that Malachi is talking about, we'll see in the context of the next two chapters, that this is preceding the first coming of Christ, and yet it's in a very very interesting sense, I think, it's a picture of what precedes the second coming as well. And so just as Haggai and Zechariah are showing us what leads up to the millennium, Malachi is giving us a sense of how things are going to wind down. That period of time that we saw in Revelation 20, where there's an apostasy at the end of the millennium, prior to Christ's second coming. But these, again, these apostasies, these backslidings on the part of the church, these are pretty regular, routine kinds of predictable apostasies. People tend to behave in a similar way. We're going to begin with Malachi 2, verse 1, and we'll work our way through this, all 17 verses, Lord willing.
Malachi 2, verse 1, "And now, O ye priests, this commandment is for you."
"And now, O ye priests, this commandment is for you. At the end of the previous chapter, the Lord had reproved his people because they had slighted his worship. But now, in the first part of this chapter, Malachi returns to the priesthood. He's focusing on the priesthood, and he's turning his concerns to their violation of the covenant which God had made with them. And the reason for this, I think, is that the very things that he's described at the end of the previous chapter, the corrupting of the worship, the profanation that attends all of that, those charges, while they are leveled at all of the people of God, they pertain particularly to the priesthood. Right? The priesthood are those who are entrusted with maintaining the worship of God without profanation. And so this is something which pertains to them. So even though the care of the worship of God is the duty of all believers, this is making it clear, I think, that it's the duty especially of those who are church officers to be concerned about not only the doctrine, but the worship of God. And they're the ones who are going to get called to account for this, by the way. This is a large part of the point. You know, people who allow, when they're in position of power and trust in the church, to allow the church to engage in corrupted worship, this is something which corrupts the office of the ministry altogether. Right? And we'll see this more as this chapter progresses. And again, I think that what we see here is that the corruption in worship, as this corruption in worship spreads throughout the church, it brings to an end a certain era. Right? The building of the Second Temple era is followed by this period of corruption. And that's what we see not only at the end, really, of the Old Testament era. We see that again at the end of the early church era. We're going to see it again at the end of the millennial era. And each time there is a coming of Christ, either typically or antitypically, and it will culminate in Christ's second coming in judgment at the end of the millennium. Right, verse 2. Malachi 2, verse 2.
If ye will not hear, and if ye will not lay it to heart to give glory unto my name, saith the Lord, I will even send a curse upon you, and I will curse your blessings. Yea, I have cursed them already, because ye did not lay it to heart.
Okay, so the charge now is very clear. I already alluded to it, but the charge is regarding their careless worship. And I think very interestingly, carelessness in worship, the profaning of the worship of God, is in fact profaning the name of God. So hymn singers, from a certain point of view, they might as well go out and just curse God outright. Because what they're doing when they introduce all these other elements is they're profaning the name of God. And as is the case so often with those who corrupt the worship of God, they wouldn't hear it, nor would they lay it to heart. They don't want to hear anything about their corruption of the worship of God. They just don't want to hear it. Right? It doesn't bother them, but this constitutes a profaning of the name of God. And furthermore, failing to lay to heart what God's word says is a failure to give glory to the name of God. So it's not just the corruption of the worship of God. That's bad enough. But the fact that they will not be entreated, that they will not lay to heart what God says, what his word says about his worship, that is failing to give glory to the name of God. And again, this is especially serious when we have to say this is a tendency that's being discovered amongst ministers and other church officers. Bad enough when the people are doing it, when the people are unconcerned, but it's really bad when this becomes so pervasive that the church officers are involved in this corrupting of the worship of God. And the point here is not only how big a great a profanation of the name of God, but what Malachi is pointing out is this affront to God never goes unpunished. But Christ, who is the Lord of hosts, Christ is the one who promises to curse those who do not glorify his name. So when you fail to sing psalms unto him, when you want to reintroduce your instrumental music or establish holy days of man's invention, all of those things, these are detrimental to the glory of the name of Christ. You're denying that he's come in the flesh. You're advancing a point of view contrary to a proper understanding of what has happened, that we've left the Old Testament dispensation and moved into the new. You've decided to add something as an element of worship other than the Psalms. So Christ promises to curse them. And saddest of all, what we're told here is that the very blessings would be cursed. It's bad enough when you have to deal with God cursing you, right? Cursing something you have. But when your blessings are turned to curses, that's the worst kind of cursing of all. Now, by this idea of the blessings being cursed, I think we should understand one of two things. Either these blessings in the church are going to be removed altogether, or at the very least, the comfort and blessing of those things is going to be taken away. Right, so they're not going to have the efficacy that they did. There's not going to be an efficacy in the preaching of the word. There's not going to be an efficacy in your prayers. All of those things are being blighted. And it really, this removal of promised blessings, we should not forget, is because the people profaned the worship of God. Saddest of all, according to this verse, is that the curse was already said to be upon the people and priests, and they were unaware of it. So when these curses fall on people, not only will they not be entreated, not only is this further profanation, but they are so stupefied in their sin that they're even unaware that they're already suffering the curses of God. Right, verse 3.
Malachi 2, verse 3. Behold, I will corrupt your seed and spread dung upon your faces, even the dung of your solemn feasts, and one shall take you away with it.
Right, I'll corrupt or I'll reprove your seed. Hard to say which interpretation there is exactly in view. But what is clear is there's a further threat because of their disobedience. So the corruption or the reproof of the seed is pointing to a fruitlessness in ministry and a judgment upon the people. In essence, God is saying he's going to make his word ineffectual. And that's a punishment for the corrupting of his worship. He's simply going to remove his spirit, and it all falls down. Now, this the effect of this is, of course, their sacrifices are going to become as unclean. How unclean? He says as unclean as the dung that was carried outside the camp, which we read about, for example, in Leviticus 4, verses 11 and 12.
Leviticus 4, verses 11 and 12. And the skin of the bullock and all his flesh, with his head and with his legs and his inwards and his dung, even the whole bullock, shall he carry forth without the camp unto a clean place, where the ashes are poured out, and burn him on the wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, shall he be burnt.
Right, so the picture is this. These people who are insensible of spiritual judgments are going to be like the dung of sacrifices that is carried away from the temple. It's vile in the sight of God. It's only fit to be cast out, cast away. And that ultimately is a result of a priesthood that's corrupting the worship of God. Why have they become this way? Why has the word become ineffectual? Why is there this problem? Why are the people accounted as dung, unclean, to be carried away from the temple? It's the corrupting of their worship, and God has blighted them. He's blinded them to the judgments, to the afflictions. They have no sense of any of that. Verse 4.
And ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with thee by, saith the Lord of hosts.
Right, so you shall know I sent this commandment unto you. What commandment are we talking about? Well, we're talking about the threatenings of judgments. And so we see in this verse Malachi's mission. You know, his mission is to strive to bring back the priesthood to their original purity, particularly so that the worship instituted under Moses would be restored to its uncorrupted state. Now God, we know God had established a covenant with the tribe of Levi, particularly with Aaron's family. He established them to be priests, and we see this in Exodus 28, verses 1 through 4.
Exodus 28, verses 1 through 4. Take thou unto thee Aaron, thy brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, even Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar, Aaron's sons. And thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron, thy brother, for glory and for beauty. And thou shalt speak unto all that are wise-hearted, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastplate and an ephod, and a robe and a broidered coat, a mitre and a girdle. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron thy brother and his sons, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office.
Okay, so God had established a covenant with the tribe of Levi, particularly Aaron and his family at the center of all of this. But they're all involved. There's an Aaronic priesthood. There's a Levitical priesthood that's been established by God. And Malachi's mission is to bring them back to an acknowledgement of purity. This is the same mission, by the way, that not only does this point to the end of an era, but the beginning of the next era. Each era begins with this call to a reform, a particular kind of reform, a reforming of the worship of God. Right? Nothing's going to change as long as there's a corruption of the worship. Everything is headed for judgment. If there's going to be another link in this cycle, it has to begin with a reformation of the worship of God. And we see this when we read Calvin. Calvin was very adamant about the reform of the worship of God. It's going to be like that prior to the millennium. But just as there's going to be this impulse prior to the millennium, it's going to be falling out at the other end. I mean, what's going to lead to the apostasy is, in fact, going to be a corrupting of the worship of God. It's going to be the same kind of thing. We should understand this is how it's going to end as well as how it begins. This is how the world began, and it's how the world is going to end. Right, so this is a link that we're seeing. Now, raising the issue of my covenant with Levi, we can see very clearly these threatenings have been framed in the context of covenant. The priests are punished not only for their violation of the purity of God's worship. That's true. They're held accountable. But they're also being punished because they're covenant breakers. And this also, I would say, joins the charge of not glorifying the name of God. You know, in covenanting, in vowing, we take upon ourselves the name of God. God's name and his covenant are joined hard together when God establishes his covenant amongst men. So there's a profanation going on. There's a breaking of covenant. There's a refusal to give glory to the name of God. All these things go together. To refuse to see this is to confess that there is no rhyme or reason to providence. And we're going to see that's exactly what the Jews kept accusing God of doing. We've seen it before, and we're going to see it again in this chapter. They're going to accuse God of just simply being arbitrary, and it's not the case. Curse causeless does not come. All right, verse 5.
Malachi 2, verse 5. My covenant was with him of life and peace. I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name.
Yeah, so the promise, we're told, of this covenant, the promise to the priest was one of life and peace. The point of this verse is this. The prophet is making the case that the breach of covenant was not on the part of God. God promised them life and peace. And their fathers, in fact, had been promised and experienced both long life and a general preservation in a measure answerable to their fidelity to the covenant. Okay, they had life and they had peace. But unlike the priests in Malachi's day, their ancestors had showed the required faithfulness and they had actually inherited the promises of the covenant. That's what's missing now. They're not obedient to the terms of the covenant. Why are they being beaten down? What's happening here? They've left off a covenant obedience. Now, the covenant that's in view is referenced a few times in the books of Moses. For example, if we look at Numbers, chapter 25, verses 12 and 13. Numbers 25, verses 12 and 13.
Verse 25, verse 12 and 13. Wherefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel.
Yeah, that's one, as I say, of a couple of places, but the point is, this covenant with the priesthood was one that was a covenant of peace, and there was this promise of an everlasting priesthood, long life. It was a covenant of life and peace. So these verses here now explain why the priests had not received what they thought belonged to them by reason of their covenant. A lot of people in the church who are always wondering, you know, why don't I get, why don't I see the blessings of the covenant in my life? And the answer is right here. they failed to perform the terms enjoined upon them by that covenant. Right? The lack of blessings was not because God had lost focus, that God had broken covenant. The lack of blessings was a result of their faithlessness in covenant duties. That's Malachi's point. That's God's point to these priests. This idea that we can receive the blessings of the covenant without yielding the obedience of the covenant. The idea that my children are going to be okay even if I don't really catechize them or discipline them. The notion that, you know, I can let my kids do whatever and God is simply going to preserve them because he's sovereign. Now, God says if you use the rod, if you do it in this way, that his blessing will be upon it. If you follow his rules, there will follow his blessing. If you ignore that, you do it not only to your peril, but to the peril of your children and your children's children. The priests here thought that they deserved the blessings of God simply because they were in covenant with God. But we have to remember the covenant has obligations, duties commanded, and it has warnings and threatenings rolled into it as well. Punishments that will be inflicted for failure to perform. Right, look at verse 6.
Malachi 2, verse 6. The law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, did turn many away from iniquity.
Yeah, and this is now continuing the argument in the previous verse. It's basically saying, look, faithful ministers must speak. They can't remain dumb. Faithful ministers, A, speak up when they're supposed to. And B, when they speak, it has to be the truth. Right? It's their job to set themselves against every kind of error that arises in the church, whether it's doctrinal or practical. So errors in doctrine and practice must be met. You can't remain silent. Now, these ministers who think that they can sit back and remain silent when they know things are wrong, doctrinally or practically, they're in violation of the covenant of Levi. Right? They're covenant breakers. God's saying, look, or Malachi is saying, in this case, you have to return to the model held forth by your ancestors. That passage from Numbers was actually a reiteration of this Levitical covenant to Phinehas, who was very zealous in seeing that the law of God was enforced. Right? The priests were actually required to know the law so that they might preside even in judicial cases. We see this in Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 and 9.
Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 and 9. If there arise a matter too hard for thee in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, and between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within thy gates, then shalt thou arise and get thee up into the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show thee the sentence of judgment.
Again, I think what we see here is this. We see, first of all, that during the millennium, there will be an unprecedented purity of worship and practice. In fact, it's got to be the very thing that's going to lead up to the millennium. But it's also going to signal the end of the millennium when that begins to break down. We saw this with the Reformation, which was just a revival time in the church. It was going along fine until people began to disregard the worship and practice of Christianity. So this purity that we're talking about in verse 6 was found in the priesthood as it was established. But by the time Malachi is talking to them, it had slipped to something which was much, much, much less. They declined greatly from that degree of purity. Nonetheless, the promise to a faithful priesthood is this, that their uprightness in walking, their covenant obedience, is going to do what? It's going to be seen in turning many from iniquity. Right? They did turn many away from iniquity. And this isn't really a visible mark of God's approbation. God is stamping that with his imprimatur and saying, this is good, I like this. But verse 7.
Malachi 2, verse 7. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law in his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts.
So now we see, if it wasn't clear before, we're told the proper function of the ministry. And it's described in such a way that it's also an indictment against the current priesthood for their failure. Ignorance, the point here is ignorance is a very great sin, especially in the ministry. But it's also a great affliction for the church to endure when those who are supposed to keep knowledge so as to teach others, when they are themselves blind. That's when the blind are leading the blind, and both are going to fall into the ditch. Now, it's not simply enough to have some competent knowledge, but this knowledge we see in this verse has to be joined with a thorough desire to increase knowledge of the law and word of God. And again, what's it going to look like going into the millennium? This is going to be something which has to characterize the ministry. And it's going to be something toward the end of the millennium that's going to start to fall apart. The very strictness going in is going to become lax at the end. Now, there's going to be a falling away. Faithful ministers do not seek to rest content with what they know, but they want to grow in understanding, precisely because they understand themselves to be the messengers of Christ. In Malachi's day, the problem was, as I would submit we see today. It appears the priests were ignorant and lacked any concern to correct that problem. That seems to be the general malady of Malachi's day. And it's going to be a malady that's going to affect the church, really, from the time of Malachi until the coming of Christ. We're going to see that. So it's a gradual tapering off. All right, verse 8.
Malachi 2, verse 8. But ye are departed out of the way. Ye have caused many to stumble at the law. Ye have corrupted the covenant of Levi, saith the Lord of hosts.
We're departed out of the way. So now the priests are being charged very openly with their faithlessness. And their guilt here is actually being multiplied. We're told that they themselves had sinned. They departed out of the way. But this isn't where it all ends. Because you see, these are the people who are supposed to be teachers of others. But because they've departed out of the way, they've caused the people to stumble at the law. Their ignorance and lack of concern is the downfall, not only of themselves, but of others. Just as when they are concerned, it has a salutary effect. It actually brings people back from the edge of destruction. So the very people were entrusted with both knowledge and study of the law so that they themselves could render righteous judgment are now chargeable with an ignorance that is destroying themselves together with the people over whom they were to preside. All of this, the prophet says, constitutes a corrupting of that covenant of Levi. Right? The fact is, the priesthood had been established to be a light shining in a dark place. Instead of being a light, they might as well have gone around pushing blind people over so that they would stumble and fall. Right? They had become themselves corrupt and destructive to the people of God. Right, verse 9.
Malachi 2, verse 9. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people, according as ye have not kept my ways, that have been partial in the law.
Okay, so herein we see are the judgments that await covenant breakers. They've been, we're told, partial. That is, not righteous in their judgments with respect to the law. This is really pointing to the fact that they had treated people in ways that showed preference for one over another. And it has a connotation of doing so for reasons other than seeing a just outcome. So there's a preference being made, but it's not the preference of a just judge. A just judge prefers the real victim. A just judge prefers to see justice and mercy meet together, right? That's what a just judge wants. But they're not concerned about that. What they've done is they've corrupted all of this by being partial. And as far as the people were concerned, it was very hard for them to detect it. Because these are the people who have neglected teaching the law. So their neglect of teaching the Word of God has made it easier for them to be partial, to fail in this great matter of showing forth righteousness. And people don't even perceive it. They don't perceive it because they don't really know what the law is. You don't know that you're being told something that's not true when you don't have anything against which to make that judgment or measure, take that measure. Now for this, we're told that God is going to inflict upon them certain penalties. He promises that just as they, through their partiality, have in fact made his law contemptible and base in the sight of men, he's going to make them, God is going to make them, base and contemptible. So their faithlessness is going to result in them being made of low esteem in the eyes of the people of God, because people are going to recognize them to be men of little confidence. They're not impartial in the law. Can't trust them. They're not trustworthy teachers. We don't know what they're going to say or do. All right, at this point, Malachi changes his direction a little bit. And we need to talk about his concerns as they arise. So we want to look at verse 10.
Malachi 2, verse 10. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, by profaning the covenant of our fathers?
Malachi now is turning his attention to the issue of marriage. And they're not unrelated. If we think about and consider, idolatry is spiritual adultery. Adultery is the denigrating and profaning of the ordinance and institution of marriage. So they do have a bearing to one another in terms of the law of God. just as they'd allowed heathen practices to corrupt their worship, now he's saying they've allowed heathenism to enter into their marriage contracts, particularly heathen women. The argument is something like this. God has chosen Israel as his peculiar people. That's the point. Have we not all one Father? He chosen them out of and apart from all the nations of the earth. Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? This is the fatherhood of God by which he creates the people distinct from all other peoples and nations. God has gathered a people out of the nations. Now, to deal partially with respect to the law is, in fact, we're told, treachery against the brother. And likewise, as we're going to see, to contract marriages with the heathen is to sin against God and those who are our brethren created by him. So all of this is a breach of covenant. That's what he's aiming at when he makes these arguments. You know, God has called men out of darkness into his light. And for us then to turn around and neglect that, to fail to see that for what it is, that is dealing treacherously with our brethren. It's a covenant breaking. You know, when men go outside of the church seeking to marry heathen wives and all of that, there's a covenant breaking. If you wonder why doesn't it generally turn out well when Christian women marry pagan men or vice versa? Why do they have so much trouble with their children? We're gonna see some indications that this is already a problem, but this is a breach of covenant. Right? This is something that is condemned by God. And it's dealing treacherously with your brethren. Okay, verse 11.
Malachi 2, verse 11. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god.
Okay. So here's how the Jews had dealt treacherously and committed an abomination in Israel. As I alluded to in the previous verse, they'd married the daughter of a strange god. What that means is they'd married the daughters of idolaters. Okay, those who worship strange gods. And this, we're told, profanes the holiness of the Lord, which he loved or ought to love. The reason is the idolater is the child of a strange god. We look at Jeremiah 2, verse 27.
Jeremiah 2, verse 27. Saying to a stock, thou art my father, and to a stone, thou hast brought me forth. For they have turned their back unto me, and not their face, but in the time of their trouble they will say, arise and save us.
Right, so idolaters are saying to their gods, just as we call God our father, they say to their gods, thou art our father. Marriage is an ordinance of God. And as such, it should be approached with care by the people of God. In fact, even under the gospel, marriage is to be contracted only with fellow believers, between believers. And we shouldn't be going out of that circle. Now, this concern about mixed marriages is very clear in Nehemiah. If we look at Nehemiah 13, verse 23.
In those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod and of Ammon and of Moab.
Okay, so Nehemiah was concerned about these mixed marriages, By the way, so had Ezra. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But this is a problem after they come back from the captivity. This is a problem that brings about, again, an end of an era. Right? The concern about mixed marriages is not only a real one, but it's one that is rooted in the history of mankind. It was a sin. This was a sin that brought about the flood and the end of the old world, Genesis 6, verse 2.
Genesis 6, verse 2. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
So, mixed marriage is what brought an end to the old world. It's something which brings the judgment of God. Remember in Matthew 24, the coming of Christ is like unto the days of Noah, when they were marrying and giving in marriage. Right? These mixed marriages, that's what he's referring to. He's not simply talking about the fact that they're marrying. That's referring to these mixed marriages. That's what brought about the flood. That's what brought about the judgment. When the church engages itself and mixes itself with the world, when it allows itself to be amalgamated with the ungodly, there's only judgment that's going to follow on that. So conversely, leading up to the millennium, what are we going to see? What should we be seeing? A concern for purity, not mixed marriages. Right? During the millennium, there's going to be the similar concern, but at the end, we're going to see the same kind of thing. That's the point of Matthew 24. Remember, these things are cyclical. We have types and antitypes. We have prophecy and fulfillment. And we have all of these different things. These things figure again and again. Human nature doesn't change. Neither does the grace of God. It's treachery precisely because for a believer, mixed marriages are striking at the very covenant which God has made with his people. And we're going to see why in just a moment. But it's important to understand that the people of God are not called to mix themselves with the heathen. Destroys the very purpose, as we'll see, the very purpose for which God has set men apart. All right, verse 12.
Not bad, 2, verse 12. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacle of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts.
Okay, so the Lord is going to cut off the man that does this. Now, the master and the scholar, that literally means him that waketh and him that answereth. You know, it's sort of like the idea of the catechizer and the one being catechized. It has to do with the one who's teaching and the one who's being taught. It's the duty of the teacher, the master, in anything, whether we're talking about religion or anything else. It's the duty of the master to awaken. And it's the duty of the scholar, the student, to be awakened. Now the warning here is that God is going to cut off the guilty. Whether they're teachers or students, ministers or people, is again, what are the priests doing? Well, they're the masters. They're the ones who are supposed to be awakening. They're the teachers. They're supposed to be awakening. They're the ministers. Awakening. People are supposed to be answering, learning. The impenitent are going to be removed from among the people of God. Even the priest is going to be removed from the tabernacles of Jacob. This separation or excommunication, because it's really what is going on, is actually referenced in Nehemiah 13, verse 28. Nehemiah 13, verse 28.
Verse 28. And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, therefore he chased him from me.
He chased him from me. And that is very likely, that verse is marking the departure of a number of Jews who go and live among the Samaritans. They marry, intermarry, and they end up building a contending temple on Mount Gerizim. It was Samaritan Pentateuch built upon this, and the woman at the well that Jesus talks to, he's addressing someone who left the remnant of the Jews at this time. What led them away? Intermarriage, mixed marriage. He drove them out of the people of God. They were cut off. Verse 13.
Malachi 2, verse 13. And this have ye done again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, or receiveth it with goodwill at your hand.
Okay, so here we see the beginning of the reasons given for condemning these marriages, the sinful effects of these marriages. Right? Those who took foreign wives from the heathen often did so during the lives of their lawful wives. Right? This is a problem. This brought many of the injured wives, women who had been wronged by this practice, to see their only help and hope was in God. And so they're presented to us here as covering the altar of the Lord with tears. Now, they've done this again, a second time. They've done this again. That's what it means, a second time. They did it once under Ezra, now they're doing it again under Nehemiah. Remember, Ezra made them divorce their wives. Now, the offense, this offense is such that it covers the altar, so that God does not even regard their offerings. It's no longer received as the offering of the faithful. It's actually been covered or supplanted by the cries of the wives that have been wronged by it. Now, this is going back to what Jesus says about leaving your gift at the altar and going and being reconciled. This is the same idea is involved here. They've wronged their wives, their lawful wives. They've taken to themselves these heathen wives. You know, whether they thought they were prettier or more submissive or whatever, they took to themselves wives and put away their lawful wives, as we're going to see. And God is not happy about this situation. Right, verse 14.
Malachi 2, verse 14. Yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant.
Yeah, so in verse 14, we're presented with these guilty husbands now asking why their sacrifices are no longer acceptable. And Malachi gives an immediate answer. And the answer is, the Lord is the witness between the husband and wife. After all, the Lord is the one who's being invoked in the covenant of marriage. When we take a vow, we enter into a covenant, we're invoking the name of God. Here's this idea now, again, of profaning the name of God, not giving glory to the name of God. It's covenant breaking. Right? He's the avenger of broken oaths and vows, and he's going to stand to the covenant which has been treacherously broken. Now, I think it's interesting. She's called here, the wife is called the wife of thy youth. To emphasize a couple of things. First of all, her early attachment to the husband. She was the first one in line. She was the one who was your, she was your first, your first wife. Right? She's the one who has the priority being the first. I think calling her the wife of the youth is also indicating that youth is a proper time for marriage. Right? Marriage makes two one flesh. And the point of all of this, if we look very carefully, is wives are to be helps, not hinderers to their husbands. Right? On the other hand, husbands are to deal with their wives as companions, not as slaves. Right? After all, she's called here the wife of thy covenant. And if you persist in breaking the covenant, it's going to call forth the displeasure of heaven. That's the point. Verse 15.
And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth.
Now, Calvin and others say, this is talking about Adam. Why did he only make one wife for Adam? He could have made more. And it's because he's seeking a godly seed. And I don't dispute that that is applicable here. But in the context of what Malachi is writing, the prophet is giving further reasons against these mixed marriages. And so I think that what he's saying is more like this. Didn't God make Israel one nation separate from all the others? But he could have made other nations. He did. It's not because his spirit was exhausted, right? He didn't only pour out his spirit upon one nation, Israel, and none of the others because he didn't have any more spirit to pour out. I mean, we know that's not the case from the New Testament. But he did so because he was setting apart the single nation of Israel, and the reason was he was seeking a godly seed, or as the Hebrew says, a seed for God. He's setting apart one nation so he can form it into a proper people from whom the Messiah is going to arise. Okay, that's, I think, the gist of the argument. That's not to rule out or say that these other things, for example, the Calvin and others have said, are wrong. They're certainly legitimate applications of this principle, I believe. Okay, so for the Israelites, then, who had returned from captivity, for them to embrace polytheism and idolatry that would have accompanied either polygamy or divorcing their lawful wives altogether, that was actually to destroy this oneness God was seeking in setting apart their nation. And it was further aggravated by them rejecting their covenant wives for heathenish wives. God is interested in this. Why? He wants a seed, a godly seed. And although that, you know, that is spoken primarily of the Messiah, it does speak to the institution of marriage. Why is it? You know, the New Testament, Paul is very clear that we should only marry in the Lord, and that we should raise up our children in the Lord, that children should be obedient in the Lord. And Paul brackets everything. Why? God is still seeking a godly seed, or seed for himself. That's why we practice covenant baptism. It's why we catechize our children, why we discipline our children. Verse 16.
Verse 16. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away, for one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously.
Okay, so this divorce of lawful wives, otherwise known as covenant wives, in order to take heathenish women, is condemned by God himself. The Lord, the God of Israel, hates this kind of divorce. And this is why, this is the only verse in the entire Bible that people appeal to when they say God hates divorce. God does not hate all divorce. Otherwise, Nehemiah, or Ezra, I should say, wouldn't have commanded divorce. Okay, he doesn't hate every kind of separation. But what he does hate is when you have two people who are in covenant with him and with one another. He hates that divorce. He hates that coming apart. And just as with Israel, God seeks a godly seed in covenant marriage. And divorce or polygamy, whichever, breaks the covenant and it destroys God's intended end in the marriage of his covenant people. Now, it's described here as covering violence with a garment. Now, by covering with a garment is meant the conjugal relations. And we can see this when we look at three different passages. Deuteronomy 22, verse 30. Ruth 3, verse 9. And Ezekiel 16, verse 8.
Deuteronomy 22, verse 30. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor discover his father's skirt.
Ruth 3, verse 9. And he said, Who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman.
Ezekiel 16, verse 8. Now when I passed by thee and looked upon thee, behold, thy time was the time of love, and I spread my skirt over thee and covered thy nakedness. Yea, I swear unto thee and entered into a covenant with thee, saith the Lord God, and thou becamest mine.
So the idea here is that these people who are doing this in these heathenish marriages, they've attempted to establish an unjust conjugal relation that requires a kind of violence. I mean, divorce is, if you think about it, if you understand, it's a tearing apart of one flesh. And what they're doing in this is they're seeking to make what is illegitimate legitimate through the very ordinance of marriage and the very covenant which they've destroyed with their lawful wives. This is a problem with so many remarriages. This presents a huge problem with remarriage. Not saying that all remarriage is wrong, but in a world where people are allowed to divorce and remarry without just cause, without right being held on either side, the remarriages are going to be these kinds of disasters that are being prognosticated here in Malachi. The divorce rate in the church is no different than in the world. In fact, it may actually be slightly higher. So they're being very solemnly warned not to proceed in this manner of wickedness. It's treachery in covenant. Or verse 17.
Verse 17. Ye have wearied the Lord with your words. Yet ye say, Wherein have we wearied him? When ye say, Everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them, or where is the God of judgment?
Okay, so the final charge laid in this chapter against the people of God is this. Although God is long-suffering, they've actually managed to weary him through their disobedience, particularly by their words. And should they ask in what way, the prophet answers, essentially said, you called evil good and good evil. And in this, there's a challenge to the providence of God that I alluded to earlier. There's a question as to God's carriage toward his people. What the Jews are doing is they refuse to acknowledge that they're actually reaping what they've sown. They're quicker to call into question God's covenant, or they'd rather deny a providence or assume that it somehow favors the wicked. In other words, these Jews have become your typical amillennialists because they seem to have little comprehension of covenantal cause and effect. They just seem to think the wicked are always going to win. They're always going to have the upper hand. They're all doom and gloom, no matter how much the church is faithful. And so it doesn't really matter to them whether or not the church really is that faithful. Amillennialists are typically lax in their view of church government, in their adoption of confessions, in the way they worship God, in their views toward the relation of the civil magistrate to the church and to the law of God. They don't really believe that there's a covenantal cause and effect. And that's what had happened to the Jews. They'd fallen into this very grievous error. Malachi is written for post-millennialists, not amillennialists, to let you know what's going on and why. You want to see the millennium come? You need to pursue purity in worship. You need to pursue doctrinal purity. You need to pursue the things that are going to bring about this change. Because we know that when the church is getting lax about these matters, it's already decaying, falling apart. And it's inevitably going to be followed by another judgment. The last judgment, of course, which will be when Christ returns in judgment at the end of the millennium. So next time, we're going to try to get through all of chapter 3 as well as chapter 4, since chapter 4 is so short, so that we can finish our talks about the prophets of the restoration.